Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to How to Create a Kick-Ass In-House Design Team. Woohoo! Rock on!
Yeah.
Hi. Rock on, yeah! I have a couple of housekeeping announcements real quick, just to go over at the beginning. Please silence all electronic devices if you can. We'd appreciate that if cell phones are quiet and the Twitters are kept to a minimum. Also, there's some feedback cards out there. If y'all could fill those out, we'd really appreciate that. It really helps South by Southwest get a good idea of how good the panels are, how good they aren't, whichever you feel. And also, final note, after this, if you want to continue the conversation, particularly in the realm of user experience, we're going to, you know, a few of us are getting together for drinks over at the Cedar Door. There's another event going on over there. This is in no way an official South by Southwest event, but a bunch of user experience people are going to go over there and have some Mexican martinis. So,
they're good.
I'll need one. All right. Again, welcome to How to Create a Kick-Ass In-House Design Team. And I'd like to introduce my panelists. To my left here is Ed Garaña, and he leads a small team of outstanding creative professionals for Hoovers Incorporated, which is a subsidiary of Dun & Bradstreet. His team handles all aspects of creative development, from print and web design to the user experience, and he truly understands life in the corporate trenches and is familiar with obstacles one faces, working for a company that is more traditional and conservative in its approach to technology and web development. Next is Irene Au, who is currently Director of User Experience at Google, where her team is responsible for design and user research and Google's products worldwide. She joined Google following 8 years at Yahoo, where she founded Yahoo's user research and interaction design practice and had worldwide responsibility for all product and platform design efforts as vice president of user experience and design. Next up is Lisa Anderson, and she is the director of user experience for Intuit's largest software division. Previously, she had the same position at, or same role at Microsoft, and she worked in Windows, MSN, and Unified Communications, and was also the executive producer for Corbis's multimedia group. And up there at the end is Tjeerd Hook. He is the design director in the Windows User Experience team at Microsoft. He's been at Microsoft since 1994, doing product design and managing design teams in Office, Windows, and MSN, including widely used products such as Internet Explorer, Windows Media Player, MSN Messenger, and the web services and top sites of MSN. His team in recent years has primarily worked on the development of the new user experience design in Microsoft Windows Vista. So, welcome everyone. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Certainly. And we're going to get this kicked off really quick and talk about, the success. How do you measure the success of a team? We want to make a kick-ass team. So what differentiates a regular run-of-the-mill design team from a team that is truly kick-ass?
Did you want to do your survey?
What's that?
Did you want to do your surveys first?
Yes, my surveys. Thank you. Oh, my gosh. I completely forgot. So we'll skip that. Remember that question in your mind. First of all, okay, Mexican martini. Okay. how many of you are manage design teams? Show of hands. My goodness, that is more than I thought. Excellent. Wow, good to see you. And who here is part of an in-house design team? Okay, wow. Excellent. Cool. Now we know. So back to the question. Sorry about that. How do we make our design teams kick ass? How do we measure that success?
I guess the way that we kind of measure success for our team, I mean, we're a small team, so we actually handle a lot of different aspects, but our measure of success is whether or not our users understand our products and our users can actually, go through the product as it's designed and understand what we're trying to communicate. And along with that, of course, we're going to have to make sure that our clients are happier, especially our internal clients, because as an in-house agency, we have nowhere to go if things don't go well and our clients don't like the product. So if we don't meet their demands, then we have nowhere to hide.
Right.
Cool. So, for me, obviously the baseline is just delivering the work and seeing people come to your teams, designers, and walking out with a smile on their face because they got a solution, right? But at some point, actually, I want to also see the designers make teams nervous. So it's not always good if your clients say, like, woohoo, we really love what this guy's doing for us. I actually like to hear now and then, like, this guy, he causes some trouble. He asks nasty questions. That's in general a good thing. And I get nervous if designers are always super, super getting along with everybody. So making the organization a little nervous and causing some trouble is actually, for me, a good sign of impact.
I think that the measure of success is really part qualitative and part quantitative. In the quantitative sense, it's how successful are the products that you're building. You know, that's kind of a reflection of how successful the design team is. Qualitatively speaking, though, I think that there is somewhat of a marketplace in even if you have an in-house team. The success of the team can be somewhat measured by how much do the product teams want to work with you, how early do they come and talk to you and seek your advice and help. The more that they want you to participate, I think is, reflection of how successful the team is.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. So I think part of it's about pull. You can get some evidence that you're actually doing a great job if people want you there or they demand that you attend meetings. But how you get there takes a while, and that's based on relationship building, as well as setting metrics, helping your team set metrics about their expectations, and that could be market share or that could be usability. But being involved in those conversations and then drawing that pull because they want you there. I think there's also anecdotal evidence of where you're building the right kind of bridges and relationships. If marketing wants your opinion or they want to create some continuity between the product and the marketing and the brand and the packaging, that shows that you've got the right kind of outreach and influence. And the same thing with support, wanting to know how their data can help drive product improvement. And if you're part of that culture and you're part of that conversation, then you know you're making progress.
So one of the things that's come up with a lot of discussions recently during South by Southwest is a question of structuring teams and how do you sort of structure out it? You've got a lot of different people. You've got your user experience designers, interaction designers, visual designers, web developers. If you have a large team, you could have lots of different types of people. How do you set up your structure of your team? Do you go with like a lot of generalists, who can sort of take care of everything, or do you go to a more structured approach where you've got a lot of specialists in one particular area? How do you set that up, and what's the variables around deciding on that sort of team structure?
Well, I know from at least a small team perspective, because we have very limited budget and resources. So right. Our team's under 10 people. So we have to oftentimes go to a somewhat more generalist kind of approach, where we have visual designers, yes, and we have interface designers, and we have user experience professionals, but we have to do about everything. So my visual designers know how to do, interface design, and my interface designers know how to do visual design, and then we also have our production people. So as a small team, we do at times have to be more general than I guess a larger team would, and oftentimes I want to make sure that my team knows that whatever products that they're working on, you have to take the holistic view. So it's almost sometimes good, at least in certain aspects, where if you are in it, kind of doing it as set up as a generalist to a degree,
right.
Not a generalist that, does everything kind of poorly, but to the degree that you know exactly what's going on with each of the product lines, that you can take that holistic view and make sure that you're not, recreating the wheel, or that you're not making a product that is actually going to be destroyed 2 months later because some other unit doesn't even realize that this product exists.
Right. And we're talking about, go ahead.
Design is subjective, it's qualitative, and everybody has an opinion about it, and everybody thinks they can design. So I will always prefer to hire best of breed when I'm building a team. And that can be best of breed generalists who are really great visual designers who know a lot about CSS and HTML, or they can be specialists who are just really awesome principal designers to, people who are very early in their careers and have a good foundation and a lot of potential for growth. So
we're talking a lot, mentioning about skills and hiring the best of the best. Are there some skills that you look for in particular when hiring designers into an in-house team as opposed to maybe like in a freelance environment or an agency environment?
Yes.
Sure.
Okay. Definitely. I mean, there is the element of follow through that you have to pay attention to. I think that for a lot of companies, when they are looking to hire an agency, they've already decided that they want to work with design. When you're an in-house, they're not necessarily sold or bought into it. So I think a key skill that you need to have in the team is the ability to influence and draw people in. So how do you draw and engage, you know, the skeptical engineers who don't want to watch usability studies or go out into the field? So I think that is really a key skill that, you know, you have to have.
Yeah, I think another thing that's critical is you have to go all the way, right? You can't have a team that where people say, "Well, I only do this," and then I don't do that part of the job, right? That's a very dangerous thing. It could either cause a ton of inefficiency because you have to have handover to other folks, and also you stand a chance that teams just start not having seeing the credibility really of your team. So you want people who can go all the way and are prepared to go all the way and prepared to meet all the constraints and do the whole nasty process of seeing parts of your ideal perfect design disappear and trying to really still deliver to what the original vision and concept was all about.
Let me go back to sort of the original question about structure and about what kind of talent you look for. I've had great success in building user experience teams that have some specificities. It doesn't mean that they're all very, very narrowly focused, but I tend to have multiple teams of interaction designers with very strong managers who understand the business. They are embedded with the product units. They understand the deadlines and the technical constraints, and they tend to sit with the teams of developers and program managers and project managers and product managers who develop the products. So they're the first line of defense, and they have feet in both camps of user experience excellence as well as product unit excellence in business and development and execution. Then I have specialists in visual design who understand brand and brand implementation and continuity, and they're responsible for looking across a suite of products. You don't want them so embedded and so narrowly focused that you lose the opportunity for that kind of continuity and brand loyalty. And then the same thing with user research. Occasionally, for a very big, long-lived project, we'll dedicate someone to usability or user research. And again, you have to have a continuum of research capabilities from everything from ethnography to other kinds of non-traditional tests and focus groups, right down to very traditional usability. But the skills and the talents that you want to look for are that leadership, communication, drive, the yearning to influence, to be creative, and to ask hard questions, as Cheard said, because you don't want to be passive and you want to create that pull. The other kind of talent I tend to go for is somebody who's very engineering focused, who can be a prototyper with a design team to help build and share a vision. But someone who wants to do Flash or Flex or Ajax, but on the other hand, loves working with designers and creating an aesthetic appeal as well as some technical foundations.
Now, I'd like to answer that question as well. The one thing that I look for when we're trying to, build this team is you have to find those people, especially if you're in-house and you're working for a corporation, a company that may not be traditionally mindset on technology as, a way to really extend their brand or really extend their product line.
Right.
So a lot of times you also have to find those people who understand what corporate life kind of is, who understand what it means to be in the corporate world and are okay with that. That understand some of the business aspects.
Right.
They have different customers than an agency might, because with an agency, you'll get an engagement, you'll build your product, your design. And then the great thing about that is you can walk away. I can walk away and leave, and I don't have to worry about the vice president who's going to come down the hall and figure out what the heck is going on with this project. Why did this not meet the demands or my goals that I wanted? But that never happens here. We always meet our goals.
Yeah,
so
of course.
Just FYI.
We have the kick-ass team.
Yeah,
right?
We have the kick-ass team. But I'm saying, for some people, that may be, the case.
The
non-kick-ass team. So that's why you want to hire the people who kind of understand that already. And then the other thing that, I like to kind of put out there as well is, if you're working in a smaller company and you're working with a smaller team, oftentimes you're going to have to find those kind of diamonds in the rough. You're going to have to find those people who may not be at this very point in time, the absolute best of the best. But you can kind of look at them and you can look at the skills and what they bring to the table and say,
right,
you know what? with a little bit of guidance and a little bit of help and, you know, a lot of, you know, I guess comfort, you can turn these people into the best of the best. And to me, that is almost one of those things that as a smaller team with limited resources, we have to do. And you get to let those people become engaged with the product and understand the product and really do, you know, wondrous things.
Right. That actually brings up a good question in terms of managing teams. You know, it's like you may have a group of people, and some of them may be very senior, some of them may be very junior, very new to the team, not a lot of experience. How do you manage, you know, designers and get them to a part where they can kick ass? You know, get them to a point where they can really do well in their jobs. How do you, you know, grow the team or stimulate them creatively? What are some strategies around, you know, really developing careers for people?
Big bat.
Well,
not be afraid to use it.
I think part of the big bat is thinking about taking responsibility for your team. I mean, you do want to have an end goal of building a kick-ass user experience team or design team who then will be there for you over and over again and build great products. Because in the end, you want to build great products, but you want to have people who are really destined to influence product quality. And I think it's important for us to take responsibility for that kind of oversight in grooming. And it also means that if people are dragging you down, you need to address that. But people who have passion and potential, it means helping them through direct mentorship and coaching and design reviews so that they have a chance to rub elbows with the better people on your team, the more experienced people on your team, and improve.
Yeah, I think that interaction is actually quite critical for various ways. Like you see, usually weaker teams have a situation where everybody's looking outward, working with their own clients, feature teams, product teams, whatever, and that they almost start to compete, but there's actually very interaction between the design folks, and you really don't feel like everybody's facing the same direction and has got each other's back, right? You got to get out of that situation and really share much more what everybody's doing. Design reviews are a great way to do that and to get the senior members of the team. And I really also feel like as the top manager of a team, that's your own responsibility to deliver that. Like there's this tendency that at some point managers start to just do email or people management and they get too distant from the work. And I think that's a real dangerous thing and a big, you know, also like you probably became the manager of the team because you really know how to do user experience design. And it's a big pity if you can't transfer that to folks. So getting the mediocre or the people who are, yeah, sort of like in the middle to excellence is a process that you need to really drive and that requires that interaction between the team.
And I think in addition to the one-on-one coaching that takes place, I think one of the things that I really enjoy about working with large design teams is the community that you can build and draw upon within an organization. So having people learn from each other, not only in design reviews, but also, you know, through like sharing of best practices and case studies. And, you know, we just saw a presentation from Luke on design pattern libraries and things like that, you know, having teams of people working together to solve problems, I think are all great approaches to getting people, you know, to learn new skills and to keep progressing, advancing in their careers.
Go back with the bat.
Back with the bat. All right.
The bat.
Excellent.
You can ask anyone over there.
The bat works. So say you've built this excellent team. You've got a lot of great people. And, but, you know, you're at this point where maybe you don't necessarily have a lot of buy-in to the organization. How do you balance strategic influence with the tactical deliverables? How do you, you know, get a seat at the table in terms of product design and product development and strategic direction for the organization, but keep, you know, cranking out, you know, the mock-ups and the designs and the wireframes and the tests and the very tactical level kind of things?
I mean, I know that we face that problem like constantly every day. I mean, like I said, especially since we're kind of a small shop where you're never going to, I mean, maybe I'm speaking out of turn, but you're never going to get away from the tactical stuff. You're going to have to do the tactical stuff. And you're going to have to be okay with doing the tactical stuff.
The one thing about
the tactical stuff that I found that you've kind of get from that is you get this reputation and you get this ability to connect with your clients and connect with other people and get this visibility in the company because you're actually doing these tactical things, these tactical jobs that have to be done all the time. Every day. And as long as you can make them the best that they can be, make them better than what the client wants, give them those innovative ideas, then more than likely, like I think we were saying, is that they'll start coming to you for more and more things ahead of time. They'll start asking you more and more of your opinions, getting you more and more a seat at the table, because after a while, they can't figure out how they did it without you because you're just making them look so good.
Yeah, there's one danger, I think, sometimes. Like, you're assuming now that all that tactical work was actually really necessary. And I have seen, and this is partially because as an in-house design team, you're not billing anybody, right? So the value of your work is not really visible or I mean, nobody's really hit by it. So if you don't communicate and keep an eye on what people are doing, teams can really suck so much time from your designers that you end up running behind every cycle, right? So everybody's constantly facing short-term deliverables and tactical stuff. Nobody has any time to really think.
You're playing catch-up, right?
And build something that has anything more to deliver. So in that case, I think you do actually have to start saying, like, no, we're not doing that work. And forcefully generate the time for your team to think about stuff, look at research, understand stuff, be creative, and deliver something that's conceptually and visionary
but
interesting.
Do you run the danger, if you haven't sort of built up that credibility, you run the danger of, if you say no, they might say, well, we'll stop coming to you.
Yeah, you have to do that very carefully. And you also, like, you have to really then put somebody on it who can monitor which results really are necessary and which aren't.
Well, so a couple of notes about timing. I don't think you build an absolute perfect team and then figure out how you're going to deploy it. So as you bring in really good people, as you're recruiting those kinds of leaders, I've often taken over teams that are funded by individual contributors only, and they are quite tactical and they are quite narrow in their thinking. So I set about to start to broaden their thinking, but I also tend to bring in leadership and management experience in over them. And so that those people, once I start hiring and they start asking those hard questions about why are you doing it this way? What is your business goals? Or how important is this feature, this function, this icon to the business? And start saying no to some of those lower priorities and focus on the high priority opportunities for the business or the biggest pain points for the users. Because sometimes people are just making these iterative improvements and you've got to stick to your guns and work on things where you can show 70% improvement, not 3% improvement that the users or the market might not ever notice. And that's tough. I mean, for a team to be that kind of proactive stance rather than reactive, that takes a while. The other is, I think, on timing. Just as Jared said, you've got to segment part of your team to start thinking about the future. Get research ahead of the curve. Get some design concept thinking ahead of the curve so you're not just being reactive and in the moment of a release.
Yeah, and one other thing that you can do is be crisp up front when a team asks for resources about the different sort of engagement levels that you can have, right? So they don't expect full dedication of a designer forever and ever in the future, but you're very crisp about how much time they are actually getting and what kind of results you're going to deliver. And we've like sometimes said to teams, like, look, you're going to get one meeting with the leadership of the team, 1 hour, and that's the feedback you get. And teams can be actually pretty happy with just that, right? And then it scales all the way up, of course, to full support end to end from beginning to end, so develop a vision and deliver.
We've talked a lot about, you know, to your point, building credibility and getting those things done that sort of builds credibility and trust with the team, you know, in order to start getting a seat at the table and being invited and playing a higher strategic role. You know, once you've done all of that, you know, how do you execute quickly? How do you continue to do great work, but also maintain this quality? I mean, top-notch quality. How do you continue to do that, but do it rapidly?
I know at least something that may kind of follow on this one is one thing that I've been doing right now is we've been trying to kind of hire production people a little bit to a certain degree. You know, we get to prioritize to some degree what are strategic and what is the most important.
Right.
But kind of, you know, talking to what Lisa and Jared were saying is that we're also looking at production people themselves to come onto our team and be those people who can actually do those, you know, really quick hit jobs. Those jobs that are, you know, just something that somebody thought of in marketing or in ad sales and like, well, we got to do this. Like, we have to do it today. And if we don't get it out today, we're all going to die and, you know, we're all going to be fired. And so what I'm trying to do now is even with a small team is it kind of hurts, but you take a couple of people and you say, you look, you're going to be our production people. You are maybe more of our, you know, our junior staff, and you're going to be able to learn and to grow, but you're going to be, you know, those people who are on call for those type of really quick hit jobs and the ones that are not prioritized at the highest level. Cause I'm going to give you my top notch team, my A team. You guys are going to be the ones that are going to just keep the business moving no matter what. So, I mean, that's kind of how we're, you know, I'm looking right at it.
I think that infrastructure is really key to kind of eliminating the like the low value kinds of or the lower value
the
kinds of activities,
the one-offs.
Yeah. So you know, having you know, like an asset library where people can just start reusing components or reusing design patterns, you know, things like that. I think also it's really important to have processes in place so that you know, like a lot of time is wasted just in the churn. Like, it's not really clear what we're building or why, or, you know, that it's not really clear who the decision makers are and who do I need to show this to in order to get approval and that sort of thing. And I think just mapping that out and making that very clear can also cut a lot of the time wasted.
Everybody hates the churn.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's an example of where you create that pull. That if you see that there's that kind of churn and there's that kind of ambiguity, there's no reason that a design manager or a lead should sit back and wait for somebody else to solve that. Go to the right people and build those relationships and ask those hard questions so that we're all moving forward in the same direction. I think there is opportunity to think about what's best done on your team and what's best left to vendors. Icons, there are specialists out there. You don't need iconographers every single day of the year. So I tend to build a budget for people who love just sitting there doing icons day after day after day, and we go through an intense 2-month period of icons. Same things with external benchmarks. I make sure I try to build enough budget so that those third-party benchmarks can be done by professional teams, allowing our researchers to stay very close to the product.
But Lisa, that brings up a good point, is that a lot of in-house design teams often end up working with outsourced or third-party vendors in order to, you know, to get some of the work done. How do you manage those relationships with what are some strategies around managing third-party relationships with vendors?
I'll start.
Okay, cool.
Ed and I were talking about this before, but you do have to build this relationship with the vendor, and you have to be very clear from the beginning. I've had a couple of people tell me that I'm a very tough negotiator, and I tend to hogtie them and get them to make agreements that they normally wouldn't do. But if you're smart about how you know agencies work, you try to really constrain the work to actual design work. I don't like to spend a lot of money on account management. I tell them we don't really need that. That what they're going to be is an extension of our design and our user experience team. And I want their design leads working with my design leads. And I don't want a lot of overhead, and I don't want a lot of places where we have to have some sort of conversation going through an account manager. So I think that's the biggest thing, and then really trying to establish quality bars in a similar language so that we're talking about the same thing. And you get an out clause. You make sure the contract is not so binding that when they're not delivering, you can't get out.
Yeah, I mean, that was a great conversation that we had, because we had that same experience where some of the best work that we've done, you know, it was kind of the most fulfilling when we've had to work with an outside agency, is when we did exactly that and we used the outside agency as an extension of our team. It wasn't that there was a black box and we would hand them off requirements and then walk away. And then 2 weeks later, we come back and say, hey, what do you got for us? It was, no, you're part of my team. So every day we're going to kind of tag up. We're going to see what's going on. I'm going to get on you just as much as I get on my people. Not that I ever get on my people. I mean, I'm the nicest person there ever could be to my team. But if I wasn't.
You and your bat?
What's that?
You and your bat?
Yeah. It's a bat of love. And it's Nerf. To me, that was like the best way we could have, you know, we could have worked. We were able to actually use the agencies to kind of augment the team. And the one thing that it really brought that we found out, you know, that we've never had this before, was it brings a freshness to the team, because these are new people that are giving the team new ideas, talking to them, sharing with them, and, you know, finding new experiences, as opposed to an agency where it's, you know, it's a black box. So I don't know if you guys ever.
The risk always is, of course, if you don't invest, that the work ends up being so fresh that it's completely disconnected and considered irrelevant. And it's not like the agency likes that either, right? But if they don't get enough information, and if you don't, transfer all your knowledge of being in the company and really understanding all these aspects successfully, then they can do anything else.
Sometimes we actually feel kind of sorry for some of the, not that we ever do this, but we've heard of people who do this, that feel kind of sorry for working, working with some of the agencies when we as a company do not give them enough information. And we almost leave them to dry because it's like, look, we're going to dish it out to you little bit by little bit. And those are the projects that never seem to really work as effectively as if we were actually making sure they were invested too and really understood the product just like we do. And kind of at the end, almost feel an affinity to the project. Like, man, if you guys ever want to do another project, we're willing to do it with you because now we understand where you're coming from.
And I think it depends on what kind of vendor. If you're doing sound design and orchestration and you've got a good creative director who knows how to do that, then you tell them that they're going to get a lot of their direction from you. If it's where you don't have that expertise, then you're going to have to rely on them, but you still know your company better. If it's doing benchmarks, you have to look at the protocol, you have to look at the screeners, you have to look at the questions and make sure you are on board with everything. When it comes to design and extending your design, whether they're going to be doing iterative design or conceptual design or brand implementation, look and feel explorations, it's important that both sides feel like it's a great partnership. You've got to be careful about not alienating your design team or have people think that you've hired all these great people, but now you're just outsourcing. That you've got to make sure that those conversations happen where everyone feels like they're on board and both parties see as an extension of your current team.
Irene, how do you communicate success and value of the design work that your team does to the company?
So I think it's really important to kind of be aware of what are the levers or the mechanisms within the company that you can take advantage of. So whether it's a formal design stakeholders review or UI review, or if it's like Google Tech Talks or whatever the culture has in the company, take advantage of that. So, I think it's kind of a two-pronged approach where there's the bottoms-up communication. So, how do you build in a culture of focusing on the users throughout the company? And I think the most effective way to do that is through a bottoms-up approach. Google has, these tech talks that, are open. Anybody can attend them. Anybody can create one or schedule one. And so that's often a really great way to share or champion, this is some of the great work we did. This is how we did it. Within Google, I think I mentioned in some other talk that, they actually have testing on the toilet series. There is a way that you code at Google, right? and part of that is, writing in unit tests, when you develop your code. And there is a whole team that's focused on educating people at the ground level, how to do these kinds of things.
So they've actually gone, they're reaching out to people where they can find them, which happens to be the toilet.
Is it literally the toilet?
Literally the
toilet. In the restroom.
It's very
right.
Cool.
So they're educating people, where they can find them. I mean, it seems like, it's really good for teams to sort of be very proactive about educating, sort of a wait and see mode, right? Mm-hmm. And say, if somebody comes and asks us a question about it, it's actually having your own, ad campaign almost.
Right. Yeah, there is a lot to be said for managing the brand and the perception of the user experience team and what that means to the company. What are the unique skills and abilities that that group brings to the product teams and what's the added value? So I talked a little bit about the bottoms up, but I think there's also a top down, and that might manifest itself in the way of, the product reviews because the executives always want to review things before they go out. So, maybe feeding to them, what are the key questions that they should be asking when they review products? So, tell me a little bit more about the early research that you did. Tell us more about the users that you're trying to build for.
Right.
That sort of thing. Yeah.
Is it similar at Microsoft? Do you have a brand and a marketing plan for?
No. We don't get any budget for that. But you definitely try to, and I think it's necessary as the leader of a team as well to really understand what your team's qualities are and what they should be and what the perception is and where the weaknesses are that you need to work on, and to sort of project a positive, energetic, sort of, you know, visionary attitude towards both the user experience community in your company and the rest of the company as a whole. And that seems kind of trivial, but I actually see a lot of teams fail at that. Like, teams get caught up in the usual challenges of the user experience discipline of, like, lack of impact, and we don't own anything, and if some VP would give you some mandate that everybody needs to listen to you, right? That's a big sign of weakness if you're asked for that usually. So you need to get out of complaining and whining state and really be positive and be part of the solution. I think.
So you shouldn't wait around for someone
to hand you
the golden key.
You really need somebody to be inspirational. You're not going to have a kick-ass team for a long time if you are not inspirational in general, because the kick-ass people will want that, I think.
Well, and it depends on the state of your team. But I think looking inward and trying to create your own identity and your own brand and your own aspirations, what values you want to uphold, I think is very important, because that way you've got a whole team going out there and espousing those same values. But on the other hand, you can think of other tactics of how you can be more effective and make sure everyone's on board. It might be to show your success ratio that you are going to make sure that every initiative team sets usability benchmarks. It's surprising how some people really, really want to make usable products, but they won't set metrics. So how can you and your designers and your researchers help them set metrics and then decide judiciously and ahead of time what's going to happen when they don't hit those bars? How are you going to test them if you're only 70% successful and it's a barrier to entry? Sometimes it's the usability leads and the design leads who have to go to management and say, for a barrier to entry, 70% is not good enough. But it might be okay for some edge case scenario where hardly anybody uses that feature. But sometimes that's going to come from you, and how you communicate about your team and what your values are is very important. And it starts within, and then you go out. And then educating on how you do your practice is just as important as making sure that all your team members are on board.
Right. Like one other thing I was thinking about, you also, of course, have to think about what audience you're projecting out to, right? Like if you're talking to the dev managers or the architects, you need to really not come across as the really insanely creative, elite design group. You want to come across as people who really understand technology, can collaborate with everybody, get stuff done, right? And are very responsible about, getting the right things built. So you have to find the right balance between, you can't be too crazy out there.
Speaking of the right balance, what are some behaviors that design teams or in-house design teams in particular should avoid in the organization?
One of my pet peeves is people saying, you should tell everybody that we own the design, right? Design is inherently a collaborative activity. And like I said earlier, everybody has an opinion, and good ideas can come from anybody and anywhere. And so I think as a user experience organization, we should embrace just accept that and embrace the ideas and use that to draw people in to start a conversation around, like, well, how could we improve this and build upon the ideas, right?
Yeah, like even if somebody comes with an idea that clearly from your perspective is not on strategy or completely clashes with something else, right? It's in general not very wise to say that's the dumbest thing I've ever seen, which I do sometimes.
Generally, that's not a good idea.
We try to always embrace, extend, and bend. So you're like, that's a great idea. How about this? How about this? How about this? How about this? And then, kind of get it on the right way.
Evolve towards a solution, right?
We have a drawer for that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's our drawer. One of the things that, I'd like to kind of answer a little bit of the other question about, how do you communicate? Well, and it's just an anecdotal. One of the things that we found oftentimes that are very helpful in a kind of corporation that we work in that actually helps communicate the value of our team and of the user experience is when the presidents and the vice presidents and all the senior management staff actually hear from users that they like our product, that they hear from customer support that users are you know, saying your product is great. You know, it's very easy to navigate. It's very easy to use. Or they hear salespeople saying, oh yeah, we just signed up, you know, X many more accounts, because part of it was their friend told them, or their, you know, other entity told them, this is a real easy to use product. It's great. I mean, to me, sometimes that actually helps to communicate that value when it's not me trying to put it out there. It's our customers actually telling you, yeah, this is great user experience. You guys are doing a great job. You know, keep up the good works. And a lot of times that's, to me, one of the most helpful things that you could do. Now, avoidable, you know, things that, you know, you want to avoid.
I think Jared hit the nail on the head, is that whining and complaining does no one any good. And all it does is hurt the brand of your team. I also will tell designers that I will provide air cover for them if they're need to learn better kind of communication and negotiation skills, I will be there for them. But if they fold their arms and say, I'm a designer, this is the way it's going to be, that I won't protect them. That's not the best way of building those virtual teams. And those virtual teams tend to be design and test and usability and development and product management or program management. And if you want them to respect you, you have to respect that virtual team as well.
You know, there is actually one thing that to me that you should avoid as a team is to stop the innovation. You know, don't ever stop being innovative. Don't ever stop trying, because it doesn't matter how many times you get shot down, you know, from the product manager of whatever or the vice president of this. You know, if you just say, you know what, forget it, I'm just going to do what you tell me and, you know, let it go, then you're never going to get to really advance your team and really create a kick-ass team. Because the kick-ass teams are like, you know, Jared was saying, is sometimes they're the people who are the ones that they're like, man, these guys are nuts but jerks. You know, I hate these guys. They're always coming up with these weird ideas. It's like, as long as you continue to move on that and continue to push on that, eventually, you know, the dam's going to break and they're going to say, you know what? You guys have been having all these ideas. This is great. You know what? I should have listened to you all 3 years ago. And as they're walking out the door with their box.
So I think I'd like to have some time left over for questions from the audience. There's a mic actually there in the middle. So if anyone has some questions, they can step up to the mic. But there's also somebody here in the front. You don't want to walk all the way back to the mic. It's right back. No, okay, that's fine. I'll repeat the question. What's the question? So the question is, you have a small company or a small team, and you want to be able to get to a point where you're growing, right? Grow to a much larger team. So how do you make that transition? How do you acquire great people, and how do you make that transition from being a small team to a larger team?
Is this all user experience people?
Actually, we do all web applications stuff. And we just
including web dev?
Yeah, we're at a point that we just need to bring on more great people. That's fun to data, by the way.
They're hiring right here in front. Right. Yeah. So acquiring.
Well, first, you
great
staple
people.
Them to the chair.
Yeah.
Shackles work well.
Acquiring
the bat.
Great people.
Have the bat.
All right. So let's. How do we do that?
Well, let me say that if you've identified people that you know are good that are working elsewhere, that's 50-60% of the problem solved. That's usually the hardest thing. The best people are always working. So that you need to get really good on selling. You need to look at your package and see if it's optimal for them. And you need to give them great projects, big problems to solve, and that you need to share the glory.
I think it's really important to find out what motivates the people that you're trying to attract, what's going to get them excited to get out of bed and go to work, you know, every day, and offer them those opportunities. And, you know, even if it can't be something that they do, you know, all of the time, maybe it's something they can do part of the time, you know.
I mean, as a small shop, just real quick, as a small shop ourselves, you know, we have that same kind of problem. And like I said in a previous answer, you know, one of the things that you have to be willing to do if push comes to shove is being able to find the diamonds in the rough and being able to build up those people and keep them as long as you can. Because you're right, as a small shop, it is going to be harder to compete with some of the bigger guys. But if you can build them up enough and attract these other up and coming people, then hopefully that your team will become a team that people want to aspire to be on, at least for, you know, a short time of a period, you know, maybe for 3-4 years. And maybe that would be enough to continually build on that until you're as large as you can be. And everybody's like, I want to go here.
I think that's a good point. You're just not always going to succeed to hire some kind of hero designer, superstar. And so you need to, in certain cases, just take the time to build those up yourself and literally hire, you know, entry-level designers straight from university and work on them for 3-4 years, and then you may have somebody.
So I think we have a question at the mic.
Yeah, I feel like hiring good designers is somewhat easy because you can kind of look at the work that they've done and you can kind of know what you expect. But I'm not just interested in hiring good designers. I'm interested in hiring good employees. How do you know someone's going to fit really well with the team, show up on time, and just be a good member of your staff?
That's a hard one.
Show up on time. Do designers ever show up on time?
10 o'clock, right?
I don't think it's easy to figure out if designers are good. I think quality of their portfolio is baseline, and then I think it's only baseline. I think then this hard stuff starts. You need to know your team values. You need to know the community, and you need to think about other attributes that you're looking for. Intelligence. Ability to handle ambiguity, ability to show leadership, strong communication skills. It doesn't mean they have to be perfect now, but you need to know where they stand. And you need to get really good at interviewing, build a great interview team that you trust, that knows those other facets. Sure, find a couple of people who are design experts or research experts to vet their basic skills. But on the other hand, you've got to do behavioral questioning when you can find out how they've handled themselves in other situations.
Check for passion. You get passion, you can go a long way.
And I think it's actually particularly important for in-house teams as well, because in the sense that, you know, you could be a rock star designer, but in an in-house environment, typically you're also sort of the account manager. You have to deal directly with a lot of internal clients and customers, marketing, product, engineering, et cetera. And so having those skills of relationship management and understanding of business goals and business processes and the practicalities of that environment, I think is also extremely important.
Yeah, and I think in addition to, you know, having a great interview process and good interview questions, don't forget to check references. You know, when I was building the team at Yahoo early on, I personally checked all the references for the people that I was bringing. And people are very honest with you about, you know, people's strengths and weaknesses and things like that. And I think that's really a great way to get insights into, you know, whether they're going to be a potentially good employee or not.
So next question.
Yeah, so I wanted to know where the boundaries are of your in-house design team, because you're kind of speaking around user experience design team, and that can run all the way out to business analysts and all the way back to middle tier and back end and front-end architects and obviously visual designers, but you're all of you, where are the edges of your design team where you hand off to development and or you take from the business group?
Sure. Well, so you always have too few resources to cover all the work. So you need to define some criteria of what you're going to do and what you're not going to do. And we usually look at like how much like traffic in a way does a certain area get. And this can include packaging, you know, or stuff that actually isn't necessarily part of the product experience. But how much is this part of our product experience and the brand going to be really touched by our end users and customers? That's a major driver for when to take something on. Then we have, of course, like business and strategic priority. Like if a certain feature isn't necessarily going to be used by everybody a lot, but you know we're going to shine a giant light on it, then you staff on that. User pain, basically. If you have data that there's some massive problems in a certain area, even if that area happens to be maybe a little bit under the cover or not too regularly seen, that's something that you'd go after. But there's a ton of work always that you'll say like, well, yeah, that's important, but it isn't important for the end user in the end for us.
If you're looking for sort of constraints, my user experience teams have always been user research and everything from field research and ethnography to usability, interaction design, visual design, writing, especially for UI text, is very, very important. And as I said, prototyping. But we tend to give and inform product planning from behavioral research and intimate customer research, but we tend to be informed by business priorities, market priorities, and we tend to partner in different ways on competitive evaluation.
One other thing that too is it's much more about end-to-end experiences these days, right? So like in the past, like we used to really focus on, say, the kind of like more cool interfaces where, say, you're already in an application and you're doing photo manipulation or something. And then we didn't really pay a ton of attention to the setup wizard or some other kind of like more dry aspect. And so the moment user research actually started to look much more end-to-end, what if your camera doesn't even work? Now you don't even get to use your beautiful photo editing kind of thing, right? And so we actually found that some of the things that we were doing were broken in the more geeky underlying parts. And so I think you have to do those kind of things so you know where to spend your time.
So we have a lot of...
Just real quick, for us, since we're a small kind of shop, I mean, we touch just about everything. I mean, we do print jobs, we do marketing campaigns, we do just about anything that we, have
t-shirts.
T-shirts. I mean, ours doesn't end because we are the only shop that we have internally that people can kind of look at. And we will do, the usability tests ourselves. We will build the prototypes. We will make production mock-ups so that they can be handed off to a dev team that actually does the heavy lifting. And then we sit and work with those developers to make sure that they're actually implementing it as closely to what we need it as possible.
Yeah, there's actually one more really important point here.
This is a great question.
That's what I want to answer. Yeah, because this is what user experience is all about, right? So another thing that we really invested in was get somebody to really be the owner of brand in product experience and interface with product marketing and the brand teams to have a great bridge there, take their stuff, put it in the product in a good way, and transfer what the product's all about and what we're really focusing on back to marketing and brand so that their messaging is actually about what you guys did. Because as trivial as that sounded in the past, that has often gone wrong, right? You'd see the marketing campaign and go like, well, actually, we didn't spend that much time on that particular functionality.
Or you know what they're going to put on the box, as Cheered said, something that they're going to shine the light on. Well, then you better make sure that it's going to work well. Or you ask to review the box copy. I've seen box copy where they're promoting a feature that we killed.
Yeah, and it, like in your user experience as well, it's not good enough to just cut out some holes here and there.
But
and say,
again,
like, marketing,
you don't
want to
show
something in.
Absolutely, you don't want to show your silos and your seams to your users. So they don't think that you have a marketing team and a development team and market research and user research. So you want that continuity of your packaging, the marketing, and the in-product experience so that there's continuity and quality all the way through.
Shut us up, John.
So we had a question up front real quick.
So on teams where you have cross-functional, where you have people that are visual designers but have interaction design sensibilities or interaction designers that have visual sensibilities, what are you doing to optimize the flow interaction, visual,
whatever. So the question there was, when you have groups of people who have a spectrum of abilities from interaction design to visual design, how do you move through that process of interaction and visual and
right.
Navigating?
You end up with, contentious.
Right. Okay.
Well, I think it is a little different in a smaller team than a larger team. We kind of were already talking about that, right? So, like in a larger team like us, you get the luxury to really, really start to put people more on places where they can kick ass and where their skills are particularly used.
From a smaller team kind of perspective, what we have to do is we have to, try to be almost kind of like we're talking about what kind of priorities and strategy you have for these type of products. We have to decide if this is a priority project that has, high strategic value to the company, then we're going to put on two different people. We're going to put a visual designer on it. We're going to put an interface designer on it, and we're going to put a user experience, analyst on it so that this is a high priority thing. And it goes through the proper steps as if we were on a larger team. But that, of course, will draw away from some more of the tactical or lesser operational tasks that we have to do. But
also a good way to educate somebody or grow somebody. Like if you know that they're not super strong in, say, hardcore problem solving, team them up with somebody who does have a real systematic approach to analyzing problems, breaking them apart, and then digging through and let them team up a little bit on a project like that.
So, and I think it's important to operate the group in such a way that you don't pigeonhole people, right. So that you have the flexibility to match the people's skills with the actual, you know, task at hand, so that it isn't a cookie cutter kind of, you know, we have this box and you have to fill in this box.
Yeah, but also, so we definitely be aware of keeping on trying to get somebody to do something that really clearly is not their strength. Like, I've seen certainly sometimes that you just give somebody a slightly different track and suddenly they really do so much better. And you realize, oh, I've been trying to get them to do this one thing.
So let's take the next question on
wasn't
the mic.
Working.
So we're going to start doing lightning round?
We're doing lightning round. We got several questions to go through, okay. So we'll go fast.
My team is dealing with a nice problem where we have a lot of good requests coming in. But when you don't charge, when you're a corporation, you don't charge for your services for your internal customers, the currency becomes time. How fast can you get to things? The left hand of the corporation doesn't always know what the right hand is doing, and you get to prioritize. Criteria is one thing, but after you've made that decision about what your priority is, I'm curious how you deal with communicating it to those internal customers. So, you know, sometimes I find myself saying, you are special and unique, just like everyone else. So how do you go about communicating to them and convincing them that you're working on the right things?
And you're saying you're special and unique to everybody, right?
Right.
All the time. I know
it's
we have that problem a lot where we have to communicate with the other teams. What we've kind of been doing as of late, and I don't know if this is, you know, good or bad, we're seeing how this is working out, is we've actually kind of put it on those teams to figure it out for themselves, is to say, look, if you guys are giving us conflicting priorities, I want you two guys, you two different teams, departments, to figure out which is the number one. So I want to see the VP mud wrestling going on, and I only want one victor coming to my team.
As a centrally funded and managed
with his bat of love.
With my bat of love.
As a centrally funded and managed team, you know, we have the luxury and the ability to prioritize our projects, and it's informed by what the business priorities are, but we also want to make sure that the team is set up for success. So we will also look at, you know, how early are we able to get involved? We're much more likely to engage if we can be involved as early as possible rather than late stage. What kind of user-facing changes are there potentially going to be? Sometimes it's a higher priority project that doesn't have a lot of user-facing change. And then also how much is the team really going to be set up for success? Like how open is the cross-functional team to working with the user experience team? In terms of, you know, once you set up those priorities, how do you communicate that to the group? I think if you have clear criteria and strategy for prioritizing your projects, you know, communicating that out and sharing it with the business leaders across the different sub-corporations in the company, people will understand if you have a clear and sound rational plan.
That's a big if, of course, right? If you have a clear vision and set of priorities from your organization.
Yeah.
So
I think it goes from bottom up. You need to have responsibility in your user experience team, but you also need some direction from the corporation. And sometimes you are the messenger and they are not happy.
You need some trust also, of course, that you will make the right business decisions. And if that's not there, then you're going to be screwed anyway. Because teams will, in a way, always want more. I think that's true probably for in-house design teams as well as agencies, right? No matter how much you kick ass for them, they'd like some more from you anytime, right?
I would say
more ass kicking.
More ass kicking. So I ask executives to do sort of what he said, which is not necessarily mud wrestle, but that with central teams, they want some clarity, and nothing bad is going to come of it if we can decide for the next year what our corporate priorities are. And then that helps us make our decisions.
So, next question.
Yeah, my question's about.
We've got 2 minutes.
Relationships between design teams and their peer departments. I am in an online team, and we work very closely with the data team, and making sure that the organization as a whole knows the responsibilities and the of those various teams and how they have to work in step. And I wonder if you could address peer departments working with online teams.
So is the data team more like the technical team, the implementers, coders, or?
Yeah, and then we also have like an editorial team. And so those three, work has to progress at the same time between those three departments. And that's a challenge at our organization.
My simple answer would be communication, and have an open communication with your partners and peers in your other teams. Because if you don't have that open communication, and if it's not honest communication, then you are going to have nothing but trouble.
Right. Speaking early and often. Next question.
How do you watch morale on your team
And if you're aware of a problem with morale, how do you inspire your team and how do you recover morale on the team?
All I'm going to say is the bat of love again.
To me, it depends. What's the source of the morale problem? Are people leaving the team or is it that they're not feeling effective?
I think at any given company, you may have multiple sources of
morale. Yeah, and so I think you need to get to know your team. You need to do this mental audit of how well your team is doing on several levels on a regular basis, performance, contribution, as well as morale. But try to go to the source and try to figure out what you can do to affect it. Sometimes it's the individual. Sometimes you've got a bad apple.
Yeah, that's possible. Like if you have a situation like that, you must act. That's the only solution at some point. Otherwise, I think it usually is rooted in the work and the potential to have impact and people feeling that they know what they're supposed to be doing, that they're unblocked to be successful. That's usually the root of real issues. You know, it's probably not like, hey, can we go bowling or something?
And you got to have that the previous answers, you got to have that open communication with your team as well. I mean, you have it with your peer clients, but if you don't have open and honest communication with your team members, then you're not going to be able to solve their morale problem. So you have to foster that environment of, you know, I'm there for you. I'm there to help you. I'm going to be here for you. You know, right. You can let me know if there is a problem.
And you've got to be judicious. If it's your poor performers and they're unhappy because you're putting pressure on them, you need to make sure that the other team members don't feel like it's a general problem, that things are happening for a reason. If your stars are unhappy, you need to figure out how to keep them really passionate and engaged.
I think we have time for one more question.
Okay, and this may be a question for the audience as much as the panel. I haven't heard the word agile mentioned, and I've also heard things like having having your priorities set for a year. My company works in an agile process. Our teams work in 1 week cycles, and we'll do company priorities out by a quarter, but we might change within the quarter. And one of the challenges for us in hiring designers is hiring designers who work agile and aren't used to like three to six month projects. So for the panel, and also if anybody has agile design experience in the crowd.
In terms of agile, you like rapid iterations, XP, extreme programming, that sort of stuff, being involved, like designers on the team
building the team.
Right. Okay.
I know for us, we actually try. We don't call it agile development all the time. We usually call it XP development, and we are kind of moving into that foray where, with a corporation, you have a lot of changing priorities and a lot of changing strategies all the time. So you're almost by rote going to be doing that no matter what, because at any point in time, you know, a president may say, this is our new strategy. So we kind of work in that environment all the time. And it is hard to find those people who already know how to do it. And a lot of times it's just learning on the job. At least for us.
Yeah, I think this is also a little bit of what we talked about earlier with giving yourself enough time to think. The big risk, of course, in these kind of processes is that these teams will never make any kind of larger investment because it would take away, like, well, we can't ship any features next release then, right, to do certain kind of real underlying things you must have fixed in order to, in the future, really get a better user experience. And you need to give yourself the time to work on that. So just like our existence is usually also justified because we can look across lots of different products and think more about how the users actually experience the product. Now you're going to need to also look across some of these milestones that those teams are operating with, keep that going, but really make sure that you have an idea and the key designers you have working on those projects know where they want to go and can get those teams to make the key investments necessary.
I don't think there's anything wrong with encouraging designers to be very flexible and fast and think on their feet. I think it's important to establish framing, because even with agile or milestones or whatever iterative kinds of stepping stones you have where the code is keeping up with the design or vice versa, that you still should have a framework that knows where you're going.
Yeah.
And it's keeping that framework in mind all the time. We're challenging the business to make sure that they have that framework, because a feature could change overnight, but you hope that the entire product direction doesn't change overnight.
Right. And how quickly are these priorities actually changing? Because there's no point in actually setting priorities. If the priorities keep changing every week, then that's not really prioritization, right?
So if you have some more questions, you can join us for a drink at the Cedar Door. And thank you very much for attending our panel.